And now for an inside look at college sports with the men in the know, JC and Morgan. Here's Mike Morgan and JC Sherbert.
And we welcome you to another installment of JC and Morgan. He is JC Sherbert of 24/7 Sports, the BigSpur.com award-winning website. I am Mike Morgan of ESPN and the SEC Network. Another week, another pod, plenty of college football to talk about even in the offseason, and yet another special guest who you know from college football, from NASCAR. Got a great show, Marty and McGee, on SEC Network, which I typically watch on Sunday mornings, and you can just kind of see them all over the place covering stuff. Also, the author of the book Sidelines and Bloodlines, Ryan McGee, kind enough to join us now from his man cave in Charlotte. Ryan, how are you?
That's right. The man cave, I'm telling you, the man cave slash ESPN radio studio slash sports center live shot location, whatever. I've been working from home for almost 15 years now. And so all this COVID stuff started and everybody's working from home, and I kind of feel like Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, I'm teaching all my neighbors are bankers and, you know, stockbrokers. I'm like, yeah, well, guys, you could totally work from home. You just got to, you know, we got to turn off the leaf blowers so we can all do our Zoom calls, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think the secret is out for a lot of businesses across the country that you don't have to go to an office 9 to 5 to be productive. That is the only good thing I could think of that's come out of a pandemic.
Yeah, or wear pants. Everybody's realized that's optional too.
So. That's right. And you know, we could all see each other on the Zoom right now from about the waist up. So there's no telling what's going on south of the equator. We just leave that to everybody's imagination. But no, I know what you're talking about, because of course you do everything from there. And this is the first time I've been broadcasting games and not being on site. And it's a transition for all of us that do that. There are some convenient things and aspects of that, but overall nothing can match being there. And I imagine for you, there's some things you missed. I was watching you guys on your show, you and Marty, a couple weeks ago during Daytona. You got to go, and Marty looked like somebody just shot his dog because he wasn't there.
Yeah.
That's, again, COVID does that to some of the assignments.
Yeah. Well, I told Marty, that's how I feel all the time, because however many shows we've done in the past, but pre-COVID, where I'm in the studio and he's at the Masters, or I'm in the studio and he's at the Kentucky Derby, or I'm in the studio. And he was at this was the first college football national championship game I've missed since, I think, 2009.
Wow.
And, you know, Marty was there. So I'm like, dude, quit complaining. I'm going to be in the Daytona. Because just so you know, this is how I feel all the time. So, yeah, no, interesting. I was looking at the date. I mean, as we record this, it was a year ago today was the last time I was on an airplane, which is amazing to think about, because I was traveling. I mean, I was traveling I was on a plane at least once a week for the better part of a few years. And so, that part of it has been odd. But, yeah, I drove to Daytona, my first time in a hotel room. I did, you know, when I did like the Myrtle Beach Bowl or BYU Coastal Carolina, I stayed at my stepmom's beach house. You know, but this is my first, but it's, you know, it's like anything else, you ease into it. And, you know, it's, we're all getting back there. The good news is, with an eye on football in the fall, schools are already talking about full capacity, and, you know, everybody wear your mask and get your shot, and we can have football like normal in the fall.
Yeah. Amen to that. And I think we are heading there. And I look at the same thing that you do. I look at that calendar, which, you know, as we're recording this now, it's March 2nd. And I think of a year ago was March 12th, and I'm in Nashville in a suit and tie with Jimmy Dykes and your partner, Marty McGee. And remember, they had announced that we were going to do the first ever games. No fans were allowed.
Right.
So it was established by Greg Sankey and everybody on down that we were going to do these games in an empty arena, but we were going to have fun with it. And Marty was going to be outside downtown Nashville to kind of catch the vibe of where all the fans were. Because remember, the fans already bought their tickets.
Sure, they were in town. There. Yeah.
Yeah, so Big Blue Nation was there. There's thousands of people in the Music City. So they're there, and then it's me and Jimmy Dykes in an empty arena about to call a doubleheader with Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, Georgia. And that was kind of like, okay, and then an hour before tip, the plug is pulled. Bob Kessling, longtime Tennessee announcer, looked at me and gave the old throat slash, like, it ain't happening.
Yeah.
And then you get back home to the hotel and you find out the college baseball season's been canceled, which is another part of my responsibilities. So my whole world on March the 12th just changed dramatically. And of course it just trickled down to everything that we know. And I look at, and I've talked about this, we've talked about this with several guests, how the, during the time frame in the summer, when there was so much unknown, you know, you're in the writing world, and I don't know how much you wrote about this, but there were a lot of writers that just really injected their own personal kind of opinions on that there shouldn't be college football. And everything was seen through the prism of this is a bad idea, this is a bad idea. And quite frankly, I found it a little bit annoying. I'm not going to lie to you. And these are writers I respect. But it was just a, well, let's just put our heads in the sand. And there's no way it can go. Thankfully, the Greg Sankeys of the world, the Bob Bowlesbys of the world, et cetera, decided it's going to be difficult. And it was, but we got through it. What was your take? Take me through the mind and the opinions of Ryan McGee during that time.
Well, I just I think about how I handled it with my family. You know, when I remember everyone's first reaction in my house was, well, what are we going to do about spring break? We were going to Hawaii. Oh. And I had to tell my wife and daughter, well, you know what? That's still 2 months away. So let's just hang on and let's see what happens. And that was kind of my approach. Still to this day is my approach. Let's just wait and let's see what happens. And, you know, unfortunately, I think if this pandemic thing had come down in a non-election year, I don't know that it would have been as polarizing as it was. And right. Everybody was so on edge about everything all the time. Thank mm-hmm. you, my uncle on Facebook or whatever, right? That everybody was just, you know, it immediately became a fight. And it should have never been a fight. It right. should have been, let's all figure out how to do this. And, you know, it was the running joke, right? If you told an SEC fan that if he wore his mask for a month, he'd get his football back in the fall, he'd do it. No, I wouldn't, because we told him that, and people still didn't do it. And so as the summer rolled on, I was never one that said we shouldn't have sports. But my concern it increased a lot throughout the summer because I saw what I saw, which is people weren't doing what they're supposed to do. And people are gonna be mad when they hear me say that out loud, but it's a fact. It just is what it is. And so Greg Sankey came on Marty McGee. It was right after July 4th, because I know I was doing the radio show from the beach. I remember when I'm at the beach, I do the show from my truck. I sit in my truck, I got my magic radio box, and I do the show.
Nice.
I remember sitting in the truck that morning, and Greg Sankey was on the show right off the top of the show, like 7 a.m. on a Saturday. And we posed the question to him, you know, what do you rate the chances of playing football in the fall? And he said, not very high.
Yeah,
I remember that. And he was so down. And it became the story of the day that day in sports mm-hmm. because, you know, but to his credit, like you said, he stuck with it and came up with some plans. And if you had told me on that day when he said that, the leader of college football, because he is, and when he said that, I was like, we're not going to play. And I that was the first time I thought, and I'm an eternal optimist to the point that it drives my friends and family crazy. But that was the first morning where I literally got off. I took my headset off and set it down. And I went, damn, we're not going to play football in the fall. And that was the first time it dawned on me, this really might be happening. And so to their credit, man, they had a plan. They stuck with it. There were 50 different plans, the 50 different conferences, teams, you know, whatever divisions of football did. And eventually, you know, everyone got some games in. And what I said all along was it was the same speech we used to give my daughter when she was 4 years old. You get what you get and you don't pitch a fit. If your team plays 12 games, congratulations. If your team plays 7 games, great. You know, when we worked the Myrtle Beach Bowl, Marty and I did on the sideline down in Conway, South Carolina on December 21st. And there was poor North Texas with half their roster on the sideline. And everyone looked exhausted. And they had a losing record. At one point, they were in my bottom 10. And now they were in a bowl game. They had one offensive player active that day who had scored a touchdown all season long. Wow. And yet, they capped App State in a fight, I mean, for a good part of the game. And so when I saw what those teams and what those kids and what those staffs and what those universities did to play football, I'll always have the greatest respect for it. But, yeah, if you'd come to me that afternoon, that Saturday afternoon after Greg Sankey said that on our show, I was never one that said we shouldn't play football. But that day I thought, we ain't playing football. Yeah. And somehow we did it.
I remember specifically that was major news when he said that, because there was nobody more stringent on, if we can make it go, we're going to make it go. But yeah. Then when you heard some doubt in his voice and his words, I think that was a major concern for all. We usually do this, Ryan, where a little bit of this is your life moment. So I want to back up for a second before we take another deep dive into college football. But your background, I think, is fascinating, because it's not the typical track that a lot of people in our profession make, right? And I first was introduced to you as a NASCAR guy. And admittedly, I'm not the biggest NASCAR fan, but I liked your work. And then I know enough to know that when the network you work for loses a major property, anything goes, right? I mean, you could either follow the property with a new network, you could find yourself without a job, you could make a transition, you can reinvent yourself. And I think a lot of the best people in our business at times have been forced to reinvent themselves and come up with other things. And I don't know if that applies to you. I don't know if that's how you'd put it. It's kind of the way I see it, because I just, all of a sudden, I saw more of Ryan McGee, the college football guy, as opposed to the NASCAR guy, because as we know, NASCAR now is featured on another network. So just take me back in time, your career, and how you've gotten to this point.
So when I my dad was a college football referee and official. Mm-hmm. That's what you mentioned in our book, Sidelines Above Lines, we wrote last fall. That's what we write about. And my dad was also a college administrator. He was a vice president at Furman. He was a vice president at Meredith College, in Raleigh, North Carolina, right across the street from NC State. While he was an ACC official, he was vice president at Furman, president at Wingate University, a Division II school, right outside of Charlotte for 20 plus years, till he retired a few years ago. And so I grew up on college campuses. So my first love were collegiate athletics. I mean, I grew up going to volleyball games and swim meets, and, you know, that's what we did. You know, when you have, I had this magic pass that identified that I was the child of an administrator. I could get into anything. I mean, at Furman University, if I was bored and I had nothing going on, my best friend and I would ride over to Furman and we'd watch a track meet, or we'd watch a softball game, or we'd watch a swim meet, we'd watch volleyball, whatever. And so I grew up loving collegiate athletics. When I went to ESPN, I went to University of Tennessee, worked in the athletic department on the video crew, Johnny Majors. I was there for the coup d'etat when Coach Majors was forced out, and which explains a lot of my opinion of Philip Fulmer over all these years. But I went to Bristol, Connecticut, right out of college, and I wanted to work on college sports. I wanted to work on college football. And when I got up there, we had 65 production assistants. That's the entry-level job, PA. You answer the phone, you rip script, you run prompter, and you cut highlights for SportsCenter. And that's your entry-level, and eventually you work your way up. I would want to be a producer. I was a broadcasting major in college at Tennessee. And so but I got in the building, and there were – I mean, ESPN at the time, I don't know how many employees we had. It wasn't a lot. But I think there were we had three Southerners. It was me – and it was Reese Davis, who was the Cal Ripken Jr. of ESPN2. He was on called the Sports Smash every hour at the top of all the hour, just doing 3 minutes of sports highlights. And then we had an editor from Greenville, South Carolina, a woman. That was it. Now, Stu Scott grew up in Greensboro. He wanted everybody to think he was from New York at that time. Eventually, he let everybody know he grew up in Greensboro. But the three Southerners in the company were us that had Southern accents. And so they come to me, and the week I started ESPN was the same week Jeff Gordon won the inaugural Brickyard 400 at Indy. I'm dating myself, but that's what it was. NASCAR was cool, man. Dale Earnhardt was at the height of his powers. The Dale Earnhardt, Rusty Wallace thing was going on. I was born in Rockingham, North Carolina. And so as NASCAR is taking off, no one in the building knows anything about it. And they come up to me and they go, "You're from North Carolina?" I go, "Yeah." "Well, you know a lot about NASCAR, right?" I'm like, "Yeah." And the truth is, I knew more than they knew, but I don't think I knew as much as they thought I knew. But what I realized was that the line of people wanting to work on college football was around the building. Mm-hmm. The line of people wanting to work on motorsports was me. And so that was a career decision I made. And I loved it. Listen, I'm a NASCAR fan. I mean, you guys are looking at me on camera. I have a bronze bust of Richard Petty in my office.
Nice.
That was my background. My dad was on pit crews when I was a kid, so I knew it. But we started a nightly motorsports show, RPN Tonight. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I was only in Bristol for a couple of years, and then they moved us, a group of us, down to Charlotte, and I've been here ever since. We started the office, which is now the big ESPN Charlotte office, where they're televising all these games remotely. So that's the short version of the story. But Reese Davis from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, was the host of RPM Tonight, our nightly motorsports show on the weekends, and I was a production assistant, eventually a producer on that show. And I left ESPN when the television contract went away the first time in 2001 to work for Fox for a few years. Mm-hmm. And eventually I came back to ESPN. But I covered college sports for ESPN, the magazine. So I wrote about college football in the magazine. But the magazine, it wasn't as high profile as obviously .com or being on game day or whatever. And so I was kind of a slow burn with college sports.
Okay.
And then when the TV contract went away again, from NASCAR away from ESPN, almost a decade ago now, I was like, well, hey, I can write about motorsports, but I've been doing all this for the magazine, college football too. So that's right. Kind of, I think, when you realize who I was.
Yeah, yeah. So you actually double dipped there for a while.
Yeah, a long time. And the magazine, I owe the magazine everything. When the magazine started in 1999, they called our RPM Tonight office looking for help. A writer did about, it was an IndyCar story. And I'm like, well, I'm producing a feature about that very story. And they're like, well, why don't you just write it? So I wrote 500 words to the magazine. That was like the third ever issue. And I had a relationship with the magazine from issue three all the way until we stopped the presses a couple of years ago. But if not for the magazine, there's no way I'd be doing what I'm doing.
You mentioned something I wanted to hit on. You know, I've spent the majority of my time in the South, but most people say I sound like I'm from St. Louis or the
right.
Midwest,
yeah,
which
yeah.
for a play-by-play guy is what you want, right?
Yeah.
And an analyst can get away with it. Like, I work with guys, like, take, for example, a Dane Bradshaw, I think does outstanding work, and he's got a thick Tennessee accent.
Go Balls, yeah.
Yeah, but on the SEC network, it plays. There was a time where, honestly, you know, you were taught, at least I was, and I know a number of other people were, if you sounded too Northern, no chance, too Southern, no chance. You wanted to find that middle ground. So I'm curious, how many times as your career was developing did somebody say, look, Ryan, you're talented and your writing speaks for itself, but as far as on air, I don't know if we can make that accent play.
That's why I became a producer.
Yeah,
that's it. Because in college, it was you can't sound like that and be play by play. I want to be a play by play guy like everyone else. My dream job would have been, I would have loved to have been a minor league baseball play by play guy. And my first job out of college was with the Asheville Tourists.
Yeah, and, me, the and Columbus part, Red Sticks. We both had some league background.
Right, and part of the reason that I took that $100 a week job with the Tourists was I had been promised that, you know, hey, we're looking into maybe starting a radio network, which they'd never had up to that point. And you could be the guy to help us out with that. That's why I took the job. And it didn't work out. But, you know, I did play-by-play for high school football, the Forest Hills Yellow Jackets in Marshville, North Carolina, birthplace of Randy Travis. And I did a little bit of play-by-play on local cable access television for Wingate University because my dad was the president. And the guy who was doing it didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, all right, let me do it. And I listen to those tapes now. In fact, we played a clip of one of those cassette tapes on Marty McGee. And everybody was like, is that even you?
Wow.
And, but I realized very quickly no one was going to hire me because of, like, I went to the winter meetings, the baseball winter meetings in Atlanta. Back then, you'd take your cassette tape and you'd drop it in these manila envelopes of all these teams. And I dropped it in 100 envelopes. And at least 80 of them said, there's no way you can do this because of what you sound like. But then I moved to New England to be a PA on ESPN, at ESPN, and hell, everybody up there, Mike and the Mad Dog, I didn't understand what they were saying. I'm like, so it's cool up here.
Right.
But back home, it's not cool because they literally, you mentioned St. Louis, everybody was supposed to sound like Tom Brokaw, right? Everybody was supposed to, you know, sound right there in the middle. And, you know, Reese Davis, Reese is from Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And when Reese arrived in yeah, he worked in Columbus, Georgia in television for a while.
That's right.
When he arrived in Connecticut, right. He worked really hard to kind of knock the top end off of his accent. And that's because that's what we were taught. And so, yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's, that's why I gave up. I mean, I honestly realized, all right, you know, I'm a pretty good producer. I'll focus on that. And it wasn't until I kind of backdoored my way into television and radio as an analyst, and started doing a little bit of Sports Center, or a little bit of NASCAR Now, which was our nightly motorsports show on ESPN, you know, during the last TV contract. I started doing it like that as an analyst, and that kind of got me in there. Now, yeah, if you had come to me at any point in my life and said that I would be, you know, the co-host of an ESPN radio show, and I'm handling traffic coming out of breaks and all that stuff, I would have told you that then everyone in the industry had been snapped away like Avengers.
Because yeah.
There's no way they'd let me do that unless they just had way too many openings.
And I'll just say this, and I'll let JC get in here. I don't want to hog up all the time, but I think part of the reason why Marty McGee is so popular, obviously you're both very talented, both have credibility in your background, in your case, a terrific writer as well. But I think people like the change of pace. I think people like Southerners like to hear certainly the Southern culture. And I know you've got the hillbilly headlines.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of stuff has never been seen before on any ESPN platform, and most others for that matter. And so I think it actually plays to your advantage now. I think it's been a good thing for you.
Well, we've been really fortunate that, and you mentioned Greg Sankey, but we had a champion in him. And very early on, you know, we started doing the Marty McGee as a podcast, and it was probably, we called it the Marty McGee, like the motorsports and music extravaganza. Like, we were just going to talk about racing and, you know, music, and Marty's way deep into the country music scene. And so that's what we're going to do. And we would have, like, you know, we'd have Dale Earnhardt Jr. on one show and Darius Rucker on the other. And eventually they dropped us into radio on a Saturday afternoon just to see how it would play. And, you know, knock on wood, it went okay. And they eventually moved us to Saturday morning. And I think Saturday morning's a good spot for us too, because we're catching the dads going to get the donuts and at the driving range. And, you know, what's been interesting though, to the point about the accent, is there's all these rules that they have about broadcasting, but a lot of our callers on Marty McGee are coming from San Francisco at 5 o'clock in the morning local on a Saturday morning. That part has caught, we get calls from Manhattan all the time in Syracuse and Detroit. And that part has caught us off guard a little bit. We knew that the dude in, you know, down in Lexington, South Carolina was probably going to call. We had no idea that, that the guy was going to call in from, you know, LA, but we get it all the time. And so I think there's a, we're very thankful for the fact that we seem to have connected with some folks, and you know, we're going to keep doing it. A lot of shows because of, we always show in the show with Hillbilly Headlines, and some of those probably bump up against some FCC problems. And when we get done with that, as soon as we get done with the show and we're laughing till we're crying, we walk out in the parking lot. Marty goes, "That's it. We're done. They're going to pull the plug," and they haven't yet. So
knock on wood.
Yeah, exactly. I do it all the time.
I remember I did a SiriusXM show with Bill King out of Nashville for about 3 or 4 years. Every Thursday we talk recruiting, you know, college football recruiting. And, you know, you'd expect a lot of SEC callers and things like that. But the two biggest fan bases outside of the SEC that we got were Rutgers.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, Rutgers, we're going to call Rutgers recruiting and Michigan. And I could see Michigan, but Rutgers kind of threw me off base. But I got quite a little following from Rutgers fans, man. I was friends with a couple of them. I didn't even know there were that many Rutgers fans out there. But, you know, back more regionally, I've seen your book about Omaha and the College World Series. And I know Mike's got a big background in college baseball. And we've got a lot of listeners that love college baseball and could be experiencing that trip, maybe, if COVID takes care of people take care of COVID for the first time this year. For those that aren't really familiar with making the trip, myself included, just kind of give us your impressions of going out there. I hear from everybody I talk to, it's one of the greatest events ever. And since I live in Chicago part of the time now, it's kind of more realistic for me to go. So for my benefit and for everybody else's benefit, you know, just kind of break that down, because that's a really unique event that, you know, some people probably are really interested in.
Yeah, it's I'm not exaggerating when I say, I mean, Mike mentioned earlier when we kind of had this rolling realism of, all right, we all focused on college basketball being canceled on March 12th. The email that I sent out to all of our ESPN.com college sports department was, quick reminder, the College World Series was just canceled, because mm-hmm. people just weren't thinking about that, because my selfish reaction immediately was, I'm not going to get to go to Omaha. And so, you know, I wrote a worst selling book 12 years ago called The Road to Omaha, as you mentioned. And that was the year that Fresno State upset, you know, pulled off the upset of upsets, number four seed in the 4-team region, and barely got in, only got in to their conference tournament because they won their last regular season series, only got in to the NCAA tournament because they won their conference tournament, and had elimination games all the way along, and ended up winning the unfortunately for Georgia fans, ended up winning the College World Series. And Rosenblatt Stadium was and is my favorite sports venue maybe of all time, outside of maybe Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
I'll second that.
Yeah, and that's why. But I'll say this too: it was great unless it rained. You know, I always tell everybody, I tell people in Omaha all the time, I miss it too. But the new ballpark doesn't leak, and the toilets work, and the elevator moves at a rate of speed that is above 1 mile per hour, which is the world's slowest elevator. Was the one at Rosenblatt Stadium. So there are things about the old ballpark I miss, but there's things about the new one. It's just, JC, you know, it's just, I love, my favorite sporting events are the ones that are such a part of the identity of the city. Mm-hmm. I love the Daytona 500. I love the Indianapolis 500. You know, I've gotten to one Women's College World Series in Oklahoma City. But I love the events that are owned by that city and by that area. And so I mean, the Rose Bowl, right? I mean, it's just, there's the identity of an event. And if you took it away from a place, I don't know what that place would be anymore. And so to me, there's no greater representation of that than the College World Series. And you can't just go to the games. You know, that's the mistake. I think it was easier to not make that mistake at Rosenblatt. But with the new ballpark, you can treat it like any ball. You can drive in and park and do the thing and leave. But you got to get there the morning of. You got to go up to the old market. You got to do all that stuff. And you need to go sit at the Blatt, which is the bar out in center field. You need to sit out there and have a couple of drinks, and you need to go over to the baseball village where they still have plastic seats from Rosenblatt you can hang out in, and go up to the Rosenblatt site is still in the parking lot at the zoo, and home plate's still there, and the foul pole, mm-hmm. The most famous right field foul pole in the history of college baseball, maybe the history of baseball, is sitting right there from LSU Miami. So I think that to me, you gotta give yourself the entire experience. Go to the Drover, eat a steak. You know, you go down to the river. You gotta really take the whole thing in, because to me, it's not just about the game. It's about the city. I love Omaha so much. Now I'll say this: I've never been to Omaha in February. So I don't know if I would love it then, but I sure love it in June.
Absolutely. It's a great event. I got to go to three of them going back to my radio days in South Carolina. My first one was in 2002. Yep. And that was the year before they went to a championship series. It was one championship game, and South Carolina went all the way to the title game, lost to Texas. But we were out there 12 days. Yeah. And if I ever wrote a book,
that would probably be it, huh, Mike? It's like we lost Mike. But I remember that South Carolina 12-day experience, and the Gamecocks lost to Texas out there and all that. Well, I'm going to keep this going real quick while we get Mike back. And, I mean, I know you went to the University of Tennessee. You talked about Philip Fulmer earlier. We ask everybody that comes on this show, so I'm just going to ask you, what are your thoughts about Vol football, Josh Heupel? I sort of thought the Vols, because they changed coaches so many times for football and men's basketball recently, that maybe all the coaching turnover would end, but it looks like it hasn't yet. So just what's your take, knowing that program, following it, and what do you think the future holds? We got a lot of Vols listeners, so I'm sure they're interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned your old coworker, man. My only goal after a Tennessee game was to get into the post game call in show and ask your dude a question. You know, and I remember the first time I got back to the dorm. I'm trying to remember who Tennessee was. My freshman year, we beat Auburn, and I remember coming back to the dorm and Bill King took my call, man. And when it was over I even got to say the thing. I'll hang up and listen to your comments. I've never been so thrilled to say that in my life.
We're going to Ryan in Knoxville. So, yeah,
exactly. But it was listen, I don't know if Josh Heupel is the coach that will get Tennessee back to where they want to be, which is the 90s and the early 2000s. But I do think that he's a guy who can build the foundation to get them there. Yeah, I don't know that he's the guy that's going to lead you to the promised land, but I think he's the guy that can, you know, be Moses and get you right up to where you can see it. Gotcha. I like Danny White a lot. And what that building needs is that building needs positive vibes. And Danny White, I mean, that dude's wearing a national championship ring from a year when he didn't win a national championship. I mean, that man knows how to manufacture some positive vibes. And so I think that my biggest concern with Pruitt from the jump was my same concern that I have with anyone who is stepping into a head coaching job for the first time, which is I know Jeremy Pruitt can coach football. I know he knows the X's and O's. That's his DNA, man. That's his dad. That's Saban. That's everybody he's ever worked with. But that's a really, really, really difficult job to step into when you don't know how to be a CEO. And he didn't know how to be a CEO. And, I remember his first SEC media days. Marty and I were doing those coaches specials like we always do. We rolled 14 guys through there, and 13 of them had a great time, and one of them looked like we put him in an electric chair. And that was Pruitt. I mean, even when we did cornbread versus biscuits, you know, he couldn't process it. And so my concern was always that, which is, you know, coaches want to just coach football. But in the pie chart of a Division I head coach's job, I mean, even Division II, Division III, wherever, but particularly at a Power 5 high-profile job like Tennessee, on that daily pie chart, football takes up a little tiny slice of it. The other part of it is CFO, CEO, guidance counselor, babysitting boosters, you know, looking at budgets, you know, all that stuff. And so I've always worried about him handling all those things. And he walked in the door, made everybody mad. He walked in the door and immediately told a lot of longtime employees, well, this is how we're going to do it because this is how Saban did it. I'm like, well, would you want to at least hear like what we have in this office and what we have in that office? And he made the classic first-time manager's mistake, which is, you know, you got to figure out who you have in the building first. One day you might replace them, but you got to figure out what you have. And I think he got off on the wrong foot. And, you know, the CEO part of the job, you know, that's what got him. I mean, this recruiting thing, that's a CEO part of the job. That's you don't might want to deal with that, but that's what you have to deal with. So that's a really long way of saying that stability should be the goal right now in Knoxville. And I know everyone wants to be Alabama when they grow up, but the reality is you need to be Auburn first. You need to figure out how to win 9 games a year, no matter how dramatic it might be. You need to figure out how to win 9 games a year, not get in trouble, play on New Year's Day, be in the conversation of winning your division, whether you do it or not. And then once you get to that level, then you can worry about being Alabama or Georgia or whoever else, but Florida. But you need to get to the second tier first before you get to the first tier. And I know Tennessee fans don't want to hear that. I know this because that's my in-laws and my college roommates and my wife. But that's just patience is what it's going to take because there's a lot of work to do. And I have said that so many times over the last decade plus, but that's just how it is.
It is amazing because I was talking about this on a show the other day. It's not as if you have to talk to your grandfather about the last time Tennessee football was relevant. Almost everybody listening to this podcast was old enough to remember Tennessee winning a national title with T. Martin, winning multiple SEC championships. Heck, played in the SEC title game 2008, thereabouts, yep. The last one. And from that point on, it's I'm not going to use the term dumpster fire because that's been used too often in so many cases. But it has gone as bad in so many facets as it possibly can in Knoxville. And it's just weird looking at Tennessee and saying, well, heck, they'll be lucky to win five games.
But it's like that. But it's weird for us, for my daughter's generation. She's 16 years old. She's going to be a high school junior next fall.
Yeah.
They've never been good in her lifetime.
Right. She doesn't
know. And guess what? She's the same age as all the guys you're recruiting.
You're recruiting, yeah.
And so, you know who Peyton Manning is to a current high school junior or senior? He's the insurance guy.
Right, right.
You know who Jason Witten is to a current 17-year-old kid? He's the retiree that was on Monday Night Football.
Right, right.
I mean, honestly, it means nothing to these kids. And so relevance is the most important thing. And, you know, I'm not one of these that thinks that, you know, Clemson and Alabama and Ohio State being in the playoff every year ruining college football. If you had taken the playoff and dropped it into any era of college football, then over a 10-year stretch, you'd have pretty much the same three teams in it every year. It's just, if you dropped it into the 70s, you know, you're going to have Oklahoma and you're going to have Alabama and you're going to have, you know, it's just whatever decade you drop it into, that's what you're going to have. But there's never been a time when immediate relevance has been more important when it comes to your recruiting, when it comes to what your fan base thinks, when it comes to how you're perceived around the country, and to an entire generation of kids. They don't, our house is covered up in Tennessee stuff. My wife grew up in Knoxville. But to my daughter, it ain't a football school. And yeah. That's tough to swallow, but that's what that generation does. So they're in a really, really tough spot. And guess who's right there with them? Nebraska. I looked this up. I went back and looked at like the final top 10. I think it was the end of the 1999 season. And it was Nebraska, Michigan, Tennessee, Miami, Florida State. They're all lost in the woods, all of them. And the question is, who's going to figure out how to get back? And as of right now, they're all struggling to do that.
They are, and you know, my line to that, kind of like yours, in theory was, well, everything's cyclical and yeah. Things change. You know, if you would have dropped that 14 playoff you're alluding to in the 90s, it would have been Nebraska, Florida State, Florida, and yep. Pick another team almost every year. And obviously a lot has changed since then. And think about the doldrums that Nebraska has hit. Florida State's in it now. Florida was in it pre-Dan Mullen. So it can change. But I got to tell you, it's getting harder and harder to convince people that it's going to change because – I think the built-in advantage is now. If you're on top now, unless there's a coaching change, so unless Saban is out, unless Dabo is out, and even Ohio State already went through one change, but they struck gold with Ryan Day, I believe, it's really hard to anticipate movement anytime soon. And I do worry. I mean, we're all the three of us are going to love college football to the day we die, right? So we're locked in. We're not part of the issue here. But TV networks, for example, are paying not millions but billions of dollars, and people that the price of a ticket has never been more to go to the games on Saturday. I do worry about the fringe all of a sudden saying, I don't know anymore. I do worry about your daughter's generation. Do they lose interest in seeing the same half dozen teams competing for the title every year? That to me is a legitimate concern.
Yeah. And it was the Dobbs Nail Boot game. So it was Tennessee, Georgia, however many years ago that was. I remember I was in the press box at Georgia prior to the game and talking to a group of the athletic administrators of Georgia. And, you know, when you're in the press box at Georgia, you can see outside the stadium, you can see down Fraternity Row. And this was a huge football game. These were two top 10 teams, obviously one of the greatest finishes we've had in college football over the last decade. And the student section halfway through the second quarter was half empty, but the lawns of the fraternity houses were all full. And I remember talking to, like, they were just frustrated. You know, why can't we get them to cross the street? And I said to them, well, how's the Wi-Fi in the stadium? What does that matter? Well, because they want to watch the other games, you know. Mm-hmm. They probably got money down on some other games, or their buddies go to Ole Miss, or you know, they want to see Georgia Tech's losing. They want to know what's going on, and just little things like that. And I told those guys that day, I said, you need to go back and study what happened to NASCAR, because I worked at NASCAR for 2 years, NASCAR Media Group, which is the like NFL Films and Race Cars. Mm-hmm. And the sales guys were across the hallway from me. This is like middle of the 2000s.
Was when Kerry Tharp there at that time?
It was, yeah. Kerry, the commander.
Yeah.
And now he's the president of the Darlington Raceway.
Right.
And so, but NASCAR was on a climb. Like if you were looking at, I like charts, obviously. If you're looking at the growth chart, it just was like, it looked like that guy from Price is Right, right? It just was, it just climbing. And as a result, you created an entire generation of salespeople that didn't know how to sell because they didn't have to, right? The phone just rang all day. It was sponsors calling sponsor race cars, and it was season ticket holders calling, you know, Bristol Motor Speedway at 100. They keep adding seats, and they can't add enough. And people are you know, bequeathing their season tickets and their will, you know, to the next generation. And I said, suddenly and unexpectedly, a plateau happened. And there wasn't a plan. And I remember those sales guys were across the hallway from me at NASCAR, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that after the market crash – in what, 2007, whenever it was, I used to have to shut my door to write because their phones rang all day long. And after the market crash, the phones quit ringing. And those guys all just sat in their office because they didn't know how to go on a sales call because they didn't have to. And I feel like with collegiate athletics, everything's been so great for so long, and everyone's just written big checks, whether it's a donor or whether it's ESPN or whether it's a season ticket, you know, someone was holding season tickets, whatever. And when the plateau is starting to happen, they don't know how to handle that. And, you know, the NFL had that one season in the middle of all the anthem stuff where everything flattened out. It didn't drop. It just flattened out. And they freaked out because they didn't have a plan. And so I told those guys in Georgia that day, I've told a million athletic directors, you need to get your smartest sports marketing doctorate students to go back and examine what happened to NASCAR, because I can't answer it. And I was in the middle of it. But the reality is that when the plateau comes or when there's a dip, you have to have a plan. And I don't know that we've seen it with the pandemic. They shut down spring sports for what, 3 weeks, and teams were already shutting down programs because they couldn't make the math work. And so you have to have a plan going forward. And maybe everybody now, because of the pandemic, realizes that.
Boy, that's an outstanding analogy. And I hadn't heard it before and really thought of it in those terms, but that really hits home, I think, to a lot of people, because a lot of college football fans are also NASCAR fans, and they've seen,
yeah,
what NASCAR went through.
What you don't want to do is you don't want to be baseball and you don't want to be NASCAR, where all anybody ever wants to do is they just want to sit around and talk about how it used to be.
Right.
And I'm starting to feel that with a lot of college football programs. And social media is the devil, man, because social media, it's all about Alabama and Clemson and Ohio State and Georgia, whoever else. And the other 130 teams, you know, they're not being talked about. And if they're not talking about you, then you go do something else. So, yeah, it's a really, really complicated – it's fascinating, but it's really complicated.
And you mentioned baseball. I get into it with old-school baseball guys all the time. And, look, baseball, football, basketball, that's been the lifeblood of me since I was 12 years old, and I've defended all three of those sports at any turn. But baseball's got an issue. And if you don't realize that, you're just – again, you're burying your head in the sand because you don't want to know about it or hear about it. But I promise you it's there. And you have to start thinking outside the box to fix it. And even college football, which has been, as you mentioned, on an incredible run, at some point you have to think about, okay, how do we evolve? Yep. We can't just rest on our laurels anymore.
Well, and you get to thinking, well, it can't just go away.
Right.
You know, it can't fail. Hey, guess what? Sears is gone. You know, yeah. I say that all the time. JCPenney is on life support. You know, right. These companies that were the titans of the world, you know, and you ask them if you can go away, and the answer is yes, you can. And so it's you have to. There are so many super literally you're on a college campus, like you work in a collection of really smart people. So get some of those people on the case, man, because I want this thing to succeed.
Amen to that. Wrapping things up, I want to get at least one question in on the book and on your relationship with your father. Jerry McGee was a longtime a football official, primarily in the ACC, but did some games at other venues as well. You know, I mentioned this has been my life since 12, as long as I can remember. Yeah. And I think we all had that point in our life as a kid. We're like, okay, I'm not going to get paid to play sports. So then you go on to level two. Well, level two for many of us was broadcasting, and knock on wood, we've all been fortunate to get into that. Well, level three for me would have been doing what your dad did. Yeah. And I did a little umpiring and I did a little football officiating back in the day and loved it. And that's why, while so many people find joy in bashing umpires and referees, I don't, because I know how hard it is. I got a taste of it. I had at a game where I was getting $12 a game, an umpire, a women's softball game, I had to toss a woman out. Yeah. I had to toss moms out because moms had worse mouths than the dads did. Yeah. So I have so much respect, and I've developed relationships with a lot of college football and basketball officials and umpires. How impactful was that on your life, what your dad did, and to see that firsthand?
Well, the simple fact of the matter is, and I think we write this on about page two of the book, they love it more than we do, because you have to. There's no way in the world that you can endure what they have to endure. And I'm not just talking about when you finally get to work the Rose Bowl. I'm talking about everything that, because what you just described, $12 a game and having to throw moms out of game, they all done that for years and years and years and years. They all started. My dad started working JV high school games and eventually, you know, worked his way up to the, you know, national championships and all that. But, you know, my dad, one of the chapters in our book is, you know, if you can work Sigma Nu Pica, you can work the Rose Bowl. And that was always dad's rule. You know, if you can get through those lower ranks. But that's what I learned, was there's three teams on the field. And what I learned was that they're working so hard and they love it. And I saw the passion for it with the officials. And I'm not just talking about when I would go with dad to Miami, Florida State. I'm talking about when I would go with dad to Elon, Lenore Ryan, right? Or to you know, Carson Newman, Gardner Webb. When I would see, they did it because they loved it. And so it's learning the game in a different way. I was never going to be big enough to play football. I weighed 110 pounds soaking wet, you know, when my dad's moved up to the ACC. And I always tell the story, my first sideline credentials were when I just turned 13, and I was on the sideline of North Carolina at Virginia, both teams in the top 10. Barry Word, who played for the Chiefs later in the NFL, scored the game-winning touchdown. And the linebacker who missed ran over me. I mean, just blew me up. And I had my camera that Santa Claus had given me, and I was taking pictures. I have a great picture of Barry Word diving over the pylon to win the game. And the linebacker, Micah Moon, the linebacker you see in the background, he missed on the tackle but blew me up. And, I mean, it was stuff flying off of me and my Velcro wallet and, you know, my hat and everything laying all over the ground. Terrible turf, you know, Virginia. And they helped me up, and everybody was worried. Are you okay? And I'm like, that's the coolest thing that's ever happened. And I realized that everyone on that sideline that day, all those other photographers, were getting paid to be there. And I'm like, how can I figure out how to do this? I never wanted to officiate because I was immediately drawn to the local TV crews and the photographers from the local paper and going to the press box and getting a free hot dog. And I was like, this is the coolest job ever. And you guys know this. The best part is getting to the stadium 2 hours early.
Yeah.
It's the best part. They're painting the lines and they're playing the music and the players are walking the field in their street clothes and you feel like you're kind of in on something. And that's how I was fortunate enough to feel as a kid because of dad. And that's why, you know, I definitely wanted to get paid to go to ball games, but I definitely did not want to officiate because I learned how to cuss in the 1980s by listening to Eddie Murphy stand-up tapes and by listening to people yell at my dad on Saturdays.
So you're a raw or delirious guy?
Yeah, I'm a early guy. So yeah. So I was in the Boy Scouts. That was the big secret, right? You take your Walkman.
You listen to Eddie Murphy.
After the scout leaders go to bed, you lay under the stars and listen to Eddie Murphy, you know, talk about his mama throwing a shoe at him.
Oh, heck yeah. Those two cassette tapes, you know, this is before we had explicit, you know, labels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the only way I could never get my mom to buy me an Eddie Murphy cassette.
Oh, no, of course not. No,
but
no.
You remember the Columbia house where you sent a penny and you got 11 free cassettes, and then eventually you had to pay for some. Well, I certainly didn't have the money as a kid to pay for them, but I got those 11 free cassettes, and Eddie Murphy was always.
And then you were out. Yeah, then you bought the one required deal, and you were gone. Oh, yeah.
I'm probably on somebody's list. Like, Mike, we'd like to approve you for this mortgage, but you still owe that $24.95 to the Columbia Cassette Club.
I bought a car. I bought a car last year, and it was a little blip on my credit. I looked at my wife, and I go, I swear, I think that might be Columbia House.
Columbia House from back in the day.
That's fantastic. Again, the book is Sidelines and Bloodlines. You know him, you love him. He is Ryan McGee. You can catch Marty and McGee. I might have said on Sunday morning. I apologize. Saturday mornings on SEC Network. Give me the exact time on that.
Yeah, Saturday mornings, 7 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Central, and up until 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central. And, yeah, and then it airs on ESPN Radio and SEC Network, and then it re-airs on the SEC Network after we're done. And, yeah, you get your coffee and, you know, while your babies are playing in the floor, you can listen to us.
Yeah, it's a great show. You guys do great work. And I got to tell you, it's the first time you and I have had an extended conversation. Just great stuff. I really love the way your career has, as I put it, kind of evolved over time. You have a certain kind of everyday guy appeal, but also very good at what you do, what you write, and what you say. So really a pleasure having you on this podcast.
Well, I've been listening to both of you guys for a long time, and so it's a pleasure to be on, and y'all call me anytime.
Thank you, Ryan. Will do. Best of luck the rest of the way, and hopefully we'll be talking about a full football season here pretty soon.
Yeah, I just want to get to Omaha first. Get me to Omaha, and then Jason will get you there too. Yeah, let's get to Omaha, and then we'll get to football.
Amen to that. We got cut off when I was going to wax poetic about my 3 years calling games in Omaha. We'll throw that in the next segment.
Yeah, we'll do that in June.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Relax. Ride with Founders. When you refinance your new or used vehicle from another financial institution, Founders will beat your existing rate by 1% to a minimum of 1.99% for autos and 4.99% for RVs, or purchase a new or used vehicle and Founders will deposit $100 into your Loyalty Select account. Lower your rate or cash in the bank. Get started on your refi or buy today at foundersfcu.com/refi or buy. Membership qualification required. Terms and conditions apply. Founders Federal Credit Union is federally insured by NC.
If you are saving for a down payment to buy a home, you may be able to drop your savings goal from 20% to less than 5%. Ameris Bank offers a wide variety of loan solutions with low and no down payment options. With a quick consultation, the man, the myth, Stuart Wingo, loan officer at Ameris Bank, can help you determine which option best fits your financial needs and gets you into your dream home. If you're looking for a variety of products, competitive rates, and exceptional service, call Stuart Wingo at 803-319-1777. You can also check him out online, AmerisBank.com/Stuart Wingo. Save thousands of dollars today by simply calling Stuart Wingo at 803-319-1777. You'll be glad that you did.
Again, special thanks to Ryan McGee for joining us. We've had some great guests on this podcast, and I do love the fact that we always go in with a plan, JC, of like, we'll just do about 20 minutes. But the great thing about the people we've had on, they've enjoyed the time. And when you're really enjoying a conversation, it's true what they say, time flies. So many of our interviews have gone long. But, heck, the great thing about a podcast is we don't have any limitations. So we just let Ryan keep going, and it was good stuff.
Yeah, and look, you know, Ryan's a guy that, you know, I've kind of admired him from afar because I'm not a NASCAR guy, you know, right. And I I'm familiar with Marty Smith and the work he does in college football, not so much in NASCAR. Always kind of liked him because he was just this different voice, and so was Ryan. You know, two Southern guys sitting around with the obvious accents, making it work. And you know, recently Marty Smith's been doing some interviews with. Another outside of sports with the Outsider.com, which is a company that my former boss Shannon Terry has started recently, and he does a great job with these country music interviews. So I thought it was kind of neat when you told me Ryan was coming on, just because I've recently been paying a lot more attention to what they do. I don't get up at 7 o'clock on Saturday. So, you know,
I always catch the second hour.
Hard for me to watch it unless it's a big game day or something. And then I will catch it, or most of the time I'm at brunch. So maybe I'm catching it on the TV at the brunch place, but yeah, just a tremendous guy. I mean, I had no idea he went to TR, Traveler's Rest. I mean, that's kind of my old stomping grounds of my home, Greenville Spartanburg. So, and then Dorman certainly is a school I'm familiar with from Spartanburg as well. And right. I do remember that one time TR beat the Cavaliers. So just a nice walk down memory lane. And, you know, good to talk to him about Omaha, Nebraska and the College World Series too, because that's something that kind of got lost in the shuffle as far as getting canceled last year because it happened so early. But certainly is a great event, Mike. And, you know, we kind of froze up a little bit when you were talking about your three experiences out there earlier when you were out there for 12 days. That's I know some people that have, you know, done that exact same thing, and certainly was a good story.
Yeah, it's like anything else in life. The first one is always the one you're going to remember the most. Mm-hmm. Boy, that sounds a little explicit, doesn't it?
Sometimes.
Yeah, of course, I'm talking about entertainment experiences. And I got to go to three in a row, 02, 03, 04. And I haven't been back since, you know, and I don't know if I'll ever get to broadcast one again. If I don't, I'm sure I'll wind up going out there anyway. And I've heard this from a number of people. TD Ameritrade is really nice. It's a superb upgrade in terms of the bells and whistles, but nothing replaces Rosenblatt. It just doesn't. There was something ultra special about that. And so the first year, we literally got there, 3-4 days early. So I was there 12 straight days. And like I said before, I got cut off. It's 12 of the best days of my life. First off, to show you how ignorant I am, I remember thinking, I pictured Omaha, Nebraska the way you would picture the movie Field of Dreams. Like, it's just a bunch of corn with a baseball field in the middle. I honestly thought that was my idea of Omaha. Now, keep in mind, I'm in my early 20s at this point. So I haven't been around, I haven't traveled to the extent I have now, and I've never really been in the Midwest. I didn't know that area. I sure as heck never been in Nebraska, so I just thought of corn. That's all I knew. And then you see the plane about the land, and there's a bunch of big buildings. Like, it's very industrial. There's a ton of very good restaurants. You know, Ryan mentioned the old market, and of course everybody's heard about the Drover, and there's Casio Steakhouse. There's just so many good things and things to do. You go right across the bridge, and there's Harrah's Casino, the only casino I've ever won money in, in a town called Council Bluffs, Iowa. So it's an incredible deal. And I remember I worked with a guy named Jim Forrest, who was a longtime radio guy, and he had gone out there one time, and he said, "Mike, I know you've been to a bunch of football and basketball stuff, but I'm telling you right now, the most underrated sporting event is Omaha. And when you get to go, you'll never forget it." And he was right. And if you just, I recommend anybody go at least once. It is so unique. And like Ryan said, don't just go to the games. I mean, get there a day early, go around the town, go to the zoo, go to the old market, go to different restaurants and spots, and really soak it all in. Because that town, I mean, that is the difference. That town, usually there's not a team from Nebraska, sometimes not even anywhere in the Midwest. Right? But they support it like it's their baby, and they pick a favorite team out of the eight and support them. And I remember like the first day of any activity was the players going to Rosenblatt. They had tables lined up. And there was an autograph session. I'm thinking, well, this might be good for the specific teams, but how many local fans are going to want a college kid's autograph? They were lined up around the block and back to get the autograph of these players.
Yeah, even the South. Yeah, and you went, I remember the first time.
Yeah.
You because there's been two times. Nebraska's gone, and you were there that year.
Oh, yeah. 30,000 Nebraska fans. Yeah.
And then Creighton went. Creighton's actually from Omaha, I guess.
I wasn't there for Creighton.
When I was a kid, I was in the 80s or maybe the mid-90s or something like that. But, yeah, it gets – But those are the only two times that it's ever happened. And like you said, they, you know, they're lined up for more than just the Huskers right there.
Oh, no question. You know, those South Carolina kids, they felt like rock stars because they were rock stars for those 12 days. All those players were. It was an incredible event, one of the favorite. I've been to a Final Four. I've been to SEC championship games. I've been to two Super Bowls. I've been to the World Series. And I'm telling you, Omaha doesn't take a back seat to anything. And you don't have to be a diehard baseball fan to really fall in love with the event. I'll say that as well. And again, no knock on the new place. One thing they're going to have to figure out is a way to get more offense injected. I mean, that was the beauty too of Rosenblatt, depending on the wind, you'd have some incredible offensive performances. And now, I mean, you've had some games in Omaha where the ball hasn't hit the warning track. I mean, that's just that's not great. I love pitching as much as the next guy, but that's not great. So I digress. I could go on and I could write a book about those 3 years in Omaha, but just to give it some other perspective, when you hear people like Orion McGee talk about Omaha, it's for a reason. It is a really, really cool deal. All right, we are going to get into some specific college football talk, JC. Not a ton, but just mention real quick some headlines. Eric Gilbert, the nation's number one tight end, I think the number two overall recruit, depending on what list you had a year ago. He goes to LSU, then supposedly he gets homesick, then he commits to Florida, which is not home. He's from Marietta, Georgia. And now he, for whatever reason, decided he's going to transfer again. So let that sweepstakes begin. North Dakota State finally loses a game. Their winning streak is done. The Salukis of Southern Illinois. North Dakota State has won, I believe, 8 of the last 9 national championships at the FCS level. So whenever they lose a game, it's big news. And Tom Herman, who was once the most coveted head coach on the free agent market that college football has seen in many, many years, gets fired from Texas and now is hired by the Chicago Bears as an offensive analyst.
Yeah, Tom Herman.
Tells me we'll see him back in college soon.
Tom Herman heading to Siberia with me up here. And I'll start with that one first. You know, Tom Herman, I think number one, and he's just going to be an analyst, so who knows. The Bears need help on offense, and I don't think anybody's ever thought that, especially on the college level, that Tom Herman was, you know, not a good offensive play caller. And so maybe he'll help there, maybe not. I think the Bears have had a bad offense for years, no matter who the coach is, and a good defense. We've all seen him on Sundays. I mean, that's just how it is. But I will say this. If you look at it, we've talked about this on the podcast a lot. College coaching now, you are going to see more guys in instead of maybe going and joining Nick Saban's staff to rehabilitate themselves and try to get another college job. I think you're going to see a lot of guys maybe go, hey, I can go be an analyst at the pro level and maybe try to plot a career path that way. And I think you're going to see more and more guys that maybe 10 years ago, because the money was virtually the same, they would have never dreamed of leaving college. But because of the transfer rule and the name, image, likeness thing coming down and the fact that the game's going to change, you're going to have perpetual recruiting, not just – I mean, recruiting was about 365, 12 months out of the year anyway. Now it's perpetual, and you're not only recruiting your guys that you have out in high school, junior college, wherever – you're having to deal with transfer guys, and then you're having to recruit your own guys on your roster. And I think that's something that really turns coaches off or has them afraid. And so if they can get to the point where you don't have to deal with that, you may have to work a little harder, you know, and work longer hours. But I think that's what you're going to see. And that's the first part of it. The second part of it is just in terms of guys coming back from the league that are offensive coaches that come back to college, I think that Joe Brady kind of set a trend in motion a couple of years ago. If you look at some of the hires, even around the SEC, Mike, you know, LSU hired a guy from the Panthers that worked with Brady. Kentucky hired a guy from the Rams. You know, South Carolina hired a guy from the Panthers. All new offensive coordinators in the Southeastern Conference to get that edge. And I thought for the last 5 years, when you just look at the creativity on offense, the NFL's probably for the first time in my lifetime and our lifetime has been a little bit ahead of the college game for whatever reason. So that may be another part of it. Maybe he's kind of going to looking to learn something. And when he comes back, he's an even better offensive coach and, you know, and all that.
Yeah. I think, look, sometimes a year away makes you a lot smarter and the perception of you becomes a lot smarter. A lot of coaches, it's amazing how brilliant they become when they go on TV. Coaches that were fired because of lack of success, they go on TV for a year or two and everybody wants them again. I don't know if I can see Tom Herman doing television. So he chose a fine choice to do some NFL. I'm sure the pay is more than adequate, but it's not going to be the kind of pay that I think if he came back to the college ranks with a year to just wash off the residue of the Texas Longhorn experience, which did not go according to plan, wasn't awful. It just didn't go according to plan, that he'll be coveted again. I mean, I think when you and I are doing this podcast a year from now, or even less than that, 10 months from now, Tom Herman's name is going to be associated with a whole lot of Power Five openings. I don't think his stock is completely dissolved yet.
Absolutely. And it's not that he didn't win at Texas. He didn't win enough. And, you know, there were some things and it rubbed some boosters the wrong way and some things like that that probably, you know, couldn't be prevented. And, you know, they just didn't win enough. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, you watched them play this year and you kind of at times you're like, well, this is Texas football. You know, this is what you're used to. Oklahoma State game comes to mind. But then you turn around and even in a win over West Virginia, you know, you beat them 17-10 and West Virginia kind of throws a wrench into your offense. And then you're like, well, that shouldn't happen. And then you lost to Oklahoma again. And then there were some losses down the stretch. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I thought that was, you know, I think you're going to see more coaches go back and forth between NFL and college, you know, than maybe, you know, we previously did. And I'm just going to leave that right there. All right, so the Southern Illinois Salukis. Mike, you know, I go through when I'm going back and forth between here and Atlanta or Nashville or all points south. I go through Carbondale, Illinois. It's about, you know, a little bit shorter drive than going to Mars. I've always sort of liked the Salukis because our guy Bruce Weber coached there before he coached Illinois and was really good. And they've always kind of been an upstart, you know, FCS team. But man, this win over North Dakota State, what, you know, 38-14 in dominant fashion, what makes it even more impressive is they played North Dakota in the opener on February 20th and got slammed 44-21 by the North Dakota, I think they're the Skyhawks. So the cracks are in the armor for the North Dakota State Bison.
Well, I think eventually somebody had to catch up, right? I mean, otherwise this was going to be like a Mountain Union situation, right? where it seemed like they won 20 in a row at division, what are they, three, right? I mean, we want to see this. And by the way, I've had this question asked to me a number of times already because people are so desperate for football all the time. We lost that spring league, the XFL, because it was poorly run. That's supposed to come back next year in one form or another.
The Rock.
A lot of people are excited about FCS football in the spring. And some people have even suggested that why don't they just do this? Because then they would steal the spotlight, right? Instead of having to kind of just be buried on the back page of the TV schedule and get an occasional game on an ESPN or ESPNU and then have to wait for the playoff for any kind of coverage. You do it in the spring, brother, and it's you got the spotlight. It's prime time for people that are craving football. The problem becomes the question I've been asked, well, how come these games aren't on TV? How come we don't see more FCS regular season games on TV? The answer is because there's nowhere to put them.
Yeah, it's not right now. Yeah.
You have to understand, right now we have basketball, women's basketball, baseball, women's softball, gymnastics, and volleyball. Now, I know for some of the people say, well, I don't watch women's basketball, just throwing out an example. That's fine, but it's not going anywhere. So, and softball's not going anywhere. So there's your Sundays. Baseball and men's basketball is your Saturdays. Friday, you've got games on TV. I just don't know. You've got nowhere to put it. You know, that's where the problem is.
And they're streaming it. I mean, you know, streaming is kind of the future, but on ESPN3, I mean, I was one of my friends coaches at Alabama State, and I sat there and watched Alabama State and Southern, which was a heck of a game the other night. Sloppy a little bit, but a heck of a game. And, you know, I got to watch Wofford and Furman play different. They didn't play each other yet, but different games, Southern Conference action the other day. But, you know, you have to go find it. It's not like during the actual football season where, you know, you've got some networks streaming some FCS games. And even during the week, you know, sometimes you'll have a good FCS game for Thursday night. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there's an interest in it. And you do have to, you do kind of have the spotlight to yourself, but you couldn't really do it. Cause then also, how are you going to handle guys that transfer up or down eligibility wise? I think you'd also run into some alumni and season ticket situations where, you know, your alumni likes to go to football games in the fall, you know, and they're not really fired up about freezing to death for the season opener and then hoping it gets warm. And
that's the deal.
Some of these schools too, Mike, are going to be in, we mentioned North Dakota State and Southern Illinois. They're going to be cold through May. I mean, it's cold in some of these places through May. So I'm not sure, you know, I'm just not sure. I mean, I think it's fine for this year.
Right.
But I, you know, next year, I think we're going to see everybody get back to normal.
Well, you just hit on it. And as two Southerners living, well, one of us still living in the South, as you put it, you've been deported to Siberia for various reasons and infractions. There's a big wall around the JC compound. We can't get into all that. It's a family show. But I was doing a show with Rick Neuheisel on Sirius XM, and I was floating that idea. I was like, Rick, why not? Let's do this. Come on, FCS in the spring. And he pointed out, he said, well, it's great if you've got an indoor facility, but a lot of these programs at that level, they can't afford that. They don't have that. So they're practicing outside, not just the games. They're practicing outside.
Yeah.
So you're going to practice. You're going to make them practice in the snow all year long. That's clearly not fair. And so I guess the idea pretty much stops there. So when I thought about again, everything's a good plan until you have to implement it. Logistics tends to get in the way of a lot of good ideas, and the logistics are not on the side of playing football in the spring. So my guess is it's a one-off.
Yeah. And look, like, okay, so there's some schools at that level, the Ivy League schools, they could write a check for an indoor facility tomorrow. I mean, you could dome the Yale Bowl if you wanted to. They got money out, you know, these schools obviously have money. They don't spend it all on athletics, but, you know, the Ivy League could do something like that. But, you know, is Illinois State University in a public school in a state like Illinois with a budget crunch and you know, all that good stuff, not to get into the politics of it or anything. I mean, they're going to be lucky to have a stadium, period. You know, they're going to be lucky to have a new grass on the practice field. So, and that's in normal Illinois, which, you know, as cold as Chicago is in the winter, that rural part of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa-ish, Mike, is that's the prairie, and the wind and the snow blows all winter long, you know. Yeah. So I wouldn't wish that on those kids, but hey, I'm happy for the kids from Carbondale knocking off the Bison, and that makes things exciting, and I'm gonna watch every weekend from now until the season ends and get to know some of these players, and I'm excited about that as a fan. But I do think it'll you know, the quicker we can get back to normal, I think the better.
Yeah, Southern Illinois, by the way, has been a quality basketball program for a long time, so it's nice to see them get in the spotlight for football as well. Their head coach, I was reading his background. He's a former player there, and when he got the job, the program was kind of on hard times, and he's doing a great job of turning that thing around in a short amount of time. So, okay, my dream of having football year-round remains something that's not going to be answered. It's
The Rock is going to save you, man.
Maybe The Rock doesn't
know
next
what
year.
The Rock is cooking.
Maybe he decides to save it next year. It's just unfathomable to me that by far and away, and you know I love me some basketball and baseball, but by far and away, the most popular sport on this great continent of ours is football. And there is no way you can convince me that there's not a market for it in the spring. When I was a kid, I was a huge Birmingham Stallions fan of the USFL.
Yeah.
Spurrier coaching the Bandits with Gary Anderson and Cliff Stout, Reggie White, Kelvin Bryant, Jim Kelly, Doug Williams, all these great players in that league. We can't have something similar now.
No, listen, dude, I went to a St. Louis Battle Hawks game last year because a friend of mine coached.
Is that A2 or A1?
What is that? That's the St. Louis Battle Hawks. No, that's the XFL last time.
I didn't even know that was a team in the XFL.
Yeah, the St. Louis Battle Hawks, wow, man. Okay. And they were playing the New York Guardians, and my friend's a coach for the Guardians, or was coach for the Guardians, and you know, the quarterback that was at Ole Miss, gosh, his name, the Hawaiian named kid, his name escapes me, but he was playing for the Battle Hawks. And then the New York team had some players from college that I recognized, and man, they packed it out. Now they were mad, and it was kind of like a gigantic protest against Stan Kroenke, who moved the Rams back to LA because there were some not so nice chants in his direction. But I mean, you know, they draped off the top of that dome there in St. Louis that they have, and then the bottom was filled up. It was loud. I mean, it was loud. And then we went to the Hooters afterward, right there near the stadium, and it was packed. And so it was good for the local economy. I thought, hey, great. So maybe the Rock gets it back going. You look at the Rock and you follow his career, and then you talk to people that may have met him every now and then. And, you know, I don't know, he could be a huge jerk, but I've never heard anything negative about the Rock. Not in print, not from the people that sort of met him every now and then. I mean, yeah. I've never heard anything negative about the Rock. So some of that positive energy, you know, may pay off and get the XFL back going.
Yeah, I don't care if the guy can't act a lick. Bottom line is he is likable, and I'm pulling for him. I think he's got a better chance of Vince McMahon, who is not necessarily the most likable guy.
Also a terrible actor.
Vince, what was he in?
Oh,
they gave McMahon
wrestling, professional wrestling, right?
You mean that fake?
Oh no! Oh,
why don't you just tell me there's no Santa Claus while you're at it?
Jeez, I didn't mean to.
Break the fourth wall there for you. That is. Oh, you just broke a kid's dreams and heart today with that information.
Yeah, it's crazy. Eric Gilbert, maybe he signs with an XFL team though, because that situation, we mentioned that first. First of all, I'll say this. Eric Gilbert, you know, there's a lot of recruits out there that people get stuck on star ratings, and then a kid will go and be a five-star player somewhere and doesn't do anything. And then everybody gets excited. Oh, where's he going to go now? You know, that kind of thing. And usually, unless it's a quarterback, that's a big red flag. Big red flag. But I'll say this. Eric Gilbert and Henry Toto are the two probably most proven commodities in the transfer portal this time around, in my opinion. And that's weird to say about a tight end and a linebacker, but you know, this kid went down to LSU, and you know, everybody had high hopes, and you know, that offense wasn't all that great this past year, but he was really, really good and potentially special, you know. So it made sense that he went to Florida, who just had one of the best years in the recent SEC history at tight end, and with Kyle Pitts. But from what I've been hearing and what I'm told, this is more like maybe an academic type of deal. And so, you know, and my friend Josh Pate sort of reported this, people that are getting mad at Dan Mullen about it, you know, maybe shouldn't be all that mad right now, and maybe just give it time to play out. I think that sucks for Florida, because I think he would have done a really good job in that system. And, you know, how are you going to replace Kyle Pitts? Well, that's probably one of the only ways you're going to do that. But, you know, we'll see kind of how it works out and where he ends up. But I think he's a special player. I think if, you know, whatever's happening academically, you know, wherever he's got to go, whoever gets him, you know, they're not going to be sorry. I thought his recruitment was kind of weird with how it played out anyway. He's from like the Cobb County, Georgia, Mike. You could probably get right on 285 and go see him.
Yeah.
We thought Georgia, you know, for a while, and then it ended up being LSU. But so we'll see where he ends up. But I, if I'm a Gator fan, I'm maybe checking myself a little bit about you know, criticizing Dan Mullen over this.
Yeah, and Dan just had a top 10 recruiting class, and they were pretty successful overall in the transfer market.
Yeah.
So it's not as if that this was like a down year. It's one of the best years Florida's had in recruiting in a while. So I don't know why they blame Dan Mullen for that. I mean, the kid is like a lot of kids his age. He's just uncertain about what he wants. And that's we see this happen with a few kids in the recruiting process every year. And I think just to kind of put a bow on this, we are now entering a time frame in a new era in college football where, and you see that we've been seeing it in basketball for years, particularly once they started doing these grad transfer rules in play, and that's been completely manipulated. These kids aren't going, they're not transferring after their senior year at one school because they really have an ambition to be a marine biologist somewhere and want to pursue their master's at another school. But I think the free agency period, I'm not saying it's going to look like the NFL, but what I am saying is I think we're going to see more and more kids that just decide to test the waters, and guys like you and me and other people are going to be keeping up with who's going to be leaving for where.
Mm-hmm. And it is sort of like free agency. Now I'll say this, you know, I think specifically, Mike, and I know you're big on this position, and this is one of the things that I think, you know, if you want to look at something Mike Morgan is always right about, and nobody's right about everything all the time, but you know, what you say is true when you talk about quarterbacks, because you always are like, you know, got to have a quarterback, got to have it, and it rings true. Mm-hmm. And it rings true. I mean, you know, you 9 times out of 10 – most of the quarterbacks you say are good, and most that aren't are not. So, I mean, I always trust that about you.
That's my only Mel Kiperism I have. I think I've got a good eye for the quarterbacks.
But. Great eye. But that position is going to be, you know, and it already sort of was, because you think about the Joe Burrows of the world. You think about Kyler Murray, transfer, Baker Mayfield, transfer, Jalen Hurts, transfer, all the guys at Oklahoma. You know, and you go and you sort of say, well, yeah, you know, these transfer quarterbacks are helping. Justin Fields obviously was a guy this year. You know, you've seen these guys lead their teams to national title appearances as transfers. And so that position specifically is going to be like the big focus. I think everywhere else there's usually a reason. And it may not even be – it may not be playing time-ish, you know, because you think about it. Well, you know, I'm the 6th wide receiver at Clemson. You know, maybe I can go someplace else and start. But, you know, you're still talking about being behind 6 other guys. You know, so how good are you really going to be going someplace else? And I've noticed that when and 24/7 Sports had a good thing about it, is when you're tracking transfers, the guys that transfer to other schools – that have gone in the first round are all quarterbacks. Very few position players outside of quarterback go in the top 3 rounds at all. You know, so you know, maybe you're getting help somewhere. Maybe you're doing this. In the case of Eric Gilbert, yeah, he's a stud. But I think when you're talking about like the pure free agency part of it, quarterbacks are going to be what really hit home, because as we all know, and as you've always said, those guys can change the game for you.
It's the reason, I mean, when we start making our predictions and rankings and everything, well, what's the first thing you look to? Who's got a quality returning starting quarterback? I mean, it all starts there. And now, if you're Alabama, then, you know, you can just, I don't want to use Nick Saban's what do they say? Blank them out like something through a horn.
Poop out another player. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Alabama, and of course, it's not like they're getting chopped liver. I realize Mac Jones was as close as they're going to become, come to a under the radar starting quarterback, and he's about to be a first round draft pick. Another guy who by the way, is not quote unquote dynamic and runs a 4.5. There's always going to be a place in football for guys who are pocket passers, in my estimation, if you're extremely accurate, which is what he is. Seemed to work pretty well for Tom Brady in another Super Bowl win. But I think when you start breaking down most teams, that's where it all starts. Yeah. And then you can tell me the supporting cast. And you can tell me how many starters are back on the O-line. What's it look like in the backfield? Who are my weapons at wideout? And obviously defense. How many returning starters do I have there? But anybody worth their salt looks at the quarterback spot first when trying to evaluate how a team is going to perform in the upcoming year. And pretty soon you and I will start taking a look at it. We got spring football around the corner, thank goodness. And we'll start looking at, for example, in the SEC, what quarterbacks are coming back and ready to lead the way. And you got some interesting turnover there for some teams. And then you've got a couple of really good returning starters. That is for sure. Do want to mention once again our favorite sponsor, Stuart Wingo. If you're looking for a new mortgage, refi, what have you, and you want to save thousands, we've already had a couple people that listen to this podcast that have taken advantage of it. One gentleman thanked me like up and down. I said, don't thank me. Thank Stuart Wingo. I'm just the messenger here. But literally, he's going to save you money. He's great to deal with. He'll help you understand what the market looks like. Don't know how much longer the interest rates are going to be this good, but no matter what they are, it's going to be a better number through Stuart Wingo of Ameris Mortgage than anybody else. No matter where you're calling from, he's got you covered. 803-319-1777. That's 803-319-1777. The only phone number I can give you that's really going to help your bank account, among other things. JC, some final thoughts. We've gone along with that's the beauty. There's like not a single football game in D1 was played, but our interview with Ryan McGee was long because
tremendous.
It was quite frankly that good. And you and I, we've always got stuff to say too.
Yeah, I enjoyed talking about it. Enjoyed the college baseball talk, and you know, certainly the talk about the little guys, the FCS teams. Maybe we can get a North Dakota State fan that's crying in his beer a little bit, or a Saluki fan, Saluki Nation, to tune in to the JC Morgan podcast. But yeah, certainly looking forward to next week and seeing who we have next as a guest, and really, really fired up about the off season and this podcast and some things coming up. So I'm extremely fired up about all this. And by the way, people, go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate us 5 stars, write a review. That helps us get noticed a little bit more than we already are.
And we thank all of you that already support and listen to us on a regular basis. Means a lot to us. JC, stay warm. Look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
You got it. For JC. And again, our thanks to Ryan McGee for chiming in as well. Mike Morgan saying so long for now. We'll see you next time.